So, as all of you can see, this is the first talk about Europe, the United States of America, and identity ecosystems. Yeah, this is Christoph Engelmann. He's a speaker today. Please have a warm applause for him. And so you might start.
Yes, well, thank you. Thank you to the organizers of the Chaos Computer Conference for having me. It's a great honor to be here. And thank you for coming at this early time after probably a long night. I guess most of you went to bed late, just like I did. I hope I can manage to catch your attention with some ideas, descriptions about digital identity policies currently taking place or being shaping up in Europe and the United States of America. Let me briefly introduce myself. You know my name, Christoph Engelmann. I work at the Leuphana University just south of Hamburg in Lüneburg and have for quite some while been studying the history and theory of cultural techniques of authentication media. So some of you, and I will get back to that in a moment, might have seen my talk 2 years ago where I gave a presentation basically on the history of authentication media and on naming, and in some ways what I'm doing today is a continuation of that. That said, my talk basically is divided in two parts. First one, as I just said, is a recap of what I said 2 years ago, because I think it's important to understand the contemporary dynamics and things taking place. And the contemporary things taking place are actually behind those two acronyms, COM2012, 238, and ENSTIC, which I will then go into in the second part of the talk. So, let's start with the recap. What's in a name? That was the title of the talk 2 years ago. I showed that the rise of the modern nation state is linked to the stabilization of naming of people. In the sense of making people, making a population addressable, and the format that has emerged is basically the name surname system. This was already talked about a little bit in the presentation on the first evening, neutral ground in a burning world. So this dates in certain parts of the world quite far back, but in the so-called developed world, or in Europe, the US, and some other parts where we have seen the emergence of the modern nation state sometime after the 17th century, the stabilization of the naming system was actually a relatively slow process which took a couple of hundred years to come to bear. So I showed that naming and identity regime emerge in economic, military, colonial, social, welfare, and migratory contexts, and that names are not a matter of choice. Instead, there are mandatory modern nation states. People are not free not to have names. And I guess nobody knows anybody who has no name, at least in the real world. Everybody has some sort of basically registered name. So at the same time, those names are basically referencing a body of an individual. And there's for all of the history of identity systems, this pesky problem of linking a certain identifier, usually like name and surname, birthdays and so forth, to a certain body. Some researchers have called this the gap between the body and the document. And closing this gap is an issue that you try to deal with basically biometrics. And pre-digital biometrics are things like handwritten signatures, which leave a trace of the body, descriptions like eye color, hair color, height, or for example, also pictures can be understood as biometrics. So basically, when I say to govern is to address, what is being, what Stato tries to be able to address is an individual's body. Also, identity is duplication, and that means control duplication with registers, meaning that if you get an identity in some sort of nation state, you usually are issued some sort of paper. Starts with the birth certificate, which is pretty much mandatory in most parts of the world. So you cannot enter a territory from, so to say, within without being registered. But the way these systems work is basically, while you have this credential, this document identifying you, there's also a so-called copy in the register which proves that you have this document and essentially makes it valid. So only this form of duplication of a register and an issued document is making or is generating the identifiability of the individual. The second part here is important. What basically happened sometime in the 19th and 20th century is this nation states monopolized these registers. You're not being registered as a citizen by some sort of private enterprise or business or even civil society organization. It is the nation state that maintains these registers. Right? In Germany, it's the Standesämter, Meldebehörden, where you have where those registers are kept. And in the US and England, there are similar institutions in place. The difference between Europe and Anglo-Saxon countries is just how important these registers are in everyday life. And they become, in a context of welfare states, ever more important, as we're going to see soon. So the last point was that identity systems are media systems changing as media change. And this is what we're seeing now. Basically, existing identity systems are built on paper-based bureaucracies. They issue you papers and they process your data on papers. Of course, there are hybrids by now, as we all know. But essentially, the history of these systems is linked to the history of the availability and of the widespread availability of paper. Now we have a new media regime for 20 or 30 years in which people conduct business, which is digital media and the internet. And everything I'm going to talk about from now on is basically describing how Stato tries to handle this media transition to a digital system and tries to create digital identities. So, by roughly the 1980s of the last century, in the developed nations, we had a system, or we had a situation, give me a second, where first world countries would uniformly do birth registration, have international travel regulated by passport system, and basically most, if not all, people neatly named and addressable. The paperwork was all tidy and well organized, and all people, with few exceptions, had an address in the form of name, surname, birthplace, postal address, and so forth. And then, of course, and that's what I just said, the internet happened. And looking back at, and what I want to do now is basically go back to the 1990s, the 80s and 90s, and show what happened when this media, when the onset of the aforementioned media's media change took place. So the internet happened, and if you look back at the time when the internet became a widespread phenomenon, one could see that, or from today's perspective, one could see that in the 20-year history in between, we have three waves of administrative attempts to create digital identities for citizens. Or to put it in other words, to give people digital names which are equivalent to the name surname system, and thus to make them addressable and to create a capacity to govern digitally. So I think I think there are these three waves. The first wave is basically the mid-90s, when the internet became a widespread phenomenon, where in the US you see the Clipper Chip initiative, the digital signature standard, and the Signaturgesetz in Germany. And I will explain those initiatives now. So, in the mid-90s, the internet became a social and economical and also a political phenomenon, and a sizable and growing amount of people conducted important parts of their life online, did business, and entirely new economic sectors began to emerge. In both Europe and the USA, governments began to draft regulations to enable digital names for their population, for the individuals. I will focus here on Germany and the American example because both of the limited time, and also I'm not an expert on the development in other European countries. In 1993, one of the first acts of the still fresh Clinton administration was that the inventor of the internet, Al Gore, introduced the proposal for the National Information Infrastructure, which in hindsight can be understood as the first serious attempt, or as one of the first serious attempts, of creating official online identities by statehood. Part of the National Information Infrastructure, this is the information superhighway you all heard about. The policy proposal was called National Information Infrastructure, but in the press it was usually referred to as the information superhighway. Part of this program was an ambitious crypto policy proposal, which essentially envisioned government-approved cryptography for all digital devices connected to IP networks, and this is namely via the Digital Signature Standard and the Escrowed Encryption Standard, ESS. So, I don't know if this is readable. This is basically the proposals in this case for the Digital Signature Standard. As you can download these from the National Institute for Standards, NIST. It's just the first page, of course. And this is the escrowed and encryption standard, which gave rise to much controversy. The escrowed encryption standard is probably better known as the Clipper Chip initiative. Anybody knows about the Clipper Chip? Okay, a few people. So I will explain a little bit because I think it's important to know this history in order to put what is happening today in context. Also, I think it might give some ideas also about the revelations that Snowden gave us, how the policy was influenced by the failure of this initiative. So the Clipper Chip initiative was named after this device, which was, if the standard would have come to bear, to be implemented in all telephones in the US. And the chip basically had two functions. It would allow encrypted voice telecommunication and at the same time what they call lawful interception of said encrypted communication via the escrowed keys. So basically there was an official and well, an officially a knowledge backdoor built into the crypto in this chip, so that if a warrant was issued, law enforcement agencies would be able to eavesdrop on the communications done by these devices, or done over these devices. The keys would be escrowed, would be held by government institutions. It is much less widely known that there was a second chip called Capstone, which basically implemented the same crypto protocols, but instead of telephones, was supposed to be implemented in personal computers. Capstone, besides the capacity to encrypt and decrypt online communication, would also have implemented the set digital signature standard. So this is an implementation of, this is one of the devices that actually contained the Capstone chip. It was a PCIMA card that was actually sold on the market, and where you were able to use this crypto chip on there. It was actually implemented, I think, in some military contexts. Anyhow, so Capstone was supposed to implement digital signatures, and the official press release in this context reads here, the National Institute of Standardization has been developing digital signatures technology that would provide a way to verify the author and sender of an electronics message. So this is the important part here. Mostly in public folklore, when people talk about the Clipper chip, they talk about eavesdropping and basically bugging telephones. But the proposal that the Clinton administration basically made and tried to implement had a much wider scope. Besides those lawful interception eavesdropping capacities, this program also envisioned digital identities for the US citizens based on an officially recognized and officially implemented cryptographic system with ciphers provided by the government, in this case by the NIST, the National Institute for Standardization, and the NSA. So the NSA was publicly part of this program, and you will find in all the documents mentioned that the NSA approved of this algorithms to be used here. So basically, and that's why I said it might illustrate some of the developments that we are seeing today, the NSA acted in the open and said, and not only NSA, basically the US government acted in the open and said, we need encrypted communication for our citizens to enable them to conduct business and so forth, prevent cybercrime, and you know all this. But at the same time, we need to be able to intercept and control those cryptographic communications. And thus, we are offering, and it was a proposal, it was not a law that actually got enacted, we are offering a public key cryptography infrastructure for basically the US situation that would allow both. On the one hand, secure communication, on the other hand, lawful interception. Right. So, of course, few people in civil society actually liked this idea. And the opposition against this policy proposal was one of the formative campaigns for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Also, the business community opposed this project strongly because they feared for their export chances if every computing device made in the US would contain a government backdoor, right? So eventually, the whole thing fell apart and never came to bear. So we're now in roughly 1996, and this is the US situation. There is a well-funded and high-level attempt to create digital identities, which basically falls apart because of the way this was set up. At the same time, in Germany, this is Helmut Kohl. I didn't find a better picture with this nice from the election campaign. Secure into the future is what it reads there. At the same time, the Helmut Kohl administration actually tried to implement their own digital identity regime and actively discussed this during the most of the first part of the 90s. And very late in during his tenure, the administration enacted the Informations- und Kommunikationsdienstegesetz, IODK, which contained the so-called Signaturgesetz. And the Signaturgesetz, which is basically valid to this day, it has been changed a couple of times, provided the legal prerequisites to create a digital equivalent for handwritten signatures and provided regulation for the implementation of an officially recognized public key infrastructure in Germany. Unlike the US system, there were no provisions for key escrow, but the government would create and maintain the root institution and of course hold the root keys from which all officially recognized digital signatures in Germany would have to be derived. The Signaturgesetz became law on January 1st, 1997, and the German government boosted it as the first digital signature law worldwide. And somewhat naively, the German government expected a widespread adaptation of digital signatures and envisioned a system where people would voluntarily use those signatures as the official address for transactions like legal contracts, for e-government, and also for healthcare and other welfare state provisions. There were actually pretty lofty e-government visions which never came to bear, and also the uptake in the market basically did not happen at all. The German government, however, continued to promote and develop its digital signature vision and programs as the solution to the internet identity problem. And in the following years, so from 1997 on, quite a bunch of pilot programs were initiated, which all relied on smart card systems, which basically implemented the provisions as outlined by the Signaturgesetz, the signature law in English. So in other words, by 1996, the German government had decided that rolling out a public key infrastructure and providing digital signatures to German citizens is an essential aspect of digital politics. And despite many setbacks, and at least four different administrations in power since then, this vision is still the vision of the German government. So the second wave of digital identity policies, of state-sponsored digital identity policies, is basically the last decade. And in this context, I will solely speak about the German example, because interestingly, in the US, not much happened. And I believe that after the Clipper chip debacle, and also after 9/11, other things were more important, and nobody really dared to touch this issue again. And also, there were fears of interfering with the explosive growth of the IT sector. Nobody really wanted to touch that market because evidently, at least the market was functioning, even from a government perspective, the inability to identify people in a legally, valid way remained. So, except some ill-fated attempts by the Bush administration to piggyback a digital signature initiative on the Real ID Act in 2005, there was no large-scale policy approach towards providing digital identities. The situation in Europe is different in the last decade. By the mid-2000, most European countries were pursuing some sort of smart card-based identity system because most European countries have identity cards, like the German identity card. And most countries tried to transition those cards to chip cards, to smart cards, and use those smart cards in some way or another to implement digital identity solutions. In Germany, this was one of the main policy areas of the ruling red-green coalition of Chancellor Schröder, which enacted a number of bills with ambitious programs to provide German citizens with smart cards holding digital signatures. Most of these laws were based on the specifications given by the aforementioned Signaturgesetz, but included some alterations made necessary by the European Union's Digital Signature Directive from 2001. Basically, the European Union said the German Signaturgesetz from 97 makes unrealistic assumptions on the necessary security levels for digital signatures. For example, the trust centers, so the secondary trust centers that companies like Deutsche Telekom or so would run, needed to be of such high security level that they were economically infeasible. This was one of the things that the European Union criticized and which had to be changed in the German Signaturgesetz. The Schröder administration initiated three projects in Germany: the elektronische Personalausweis, which is the electronic ID card. Today, it's called the neue Personalausweis because some sort of PR agency did some research and found out that electronic has some connotations that make people suspicious. So neuer Personalausweis sounds nicer, which just means new personal ID card. So one of the projects was the elektronische Personalausweis. Second project was the elektronische Gesundheitskarte, electronic healthcare card, and the third project was the so-called job card. The Personalausweis, which you see here with the former Minister of Interior Otto Schily, is the ID card that every German is expected to have. Which actually most Germans also own. There's actually no obligation to have one, you just have to have either a passport or an ID card. But most people in Germany have this ID card because it's used fairly often. So the legal prerequisites of the electronic ID card were enacted in November 2011 in the so-called anti-terror law, where they basically used the chance of the impact of 9/11 to say we need electronic identification media because it makes it easier to find terrorists. It's the usual story. The system, of course, and the law had been shaping up for much longer before. It was just a good chance to enact it. The actual rollout of this electronic identity card only took place since October 2010, and by now around 20 million are rolled out to the German citizens, and in another 10 years, all 80 million German citizens should have one of these in their pockets. This ID card contains a chip, which again holds the private key of a digital signature infrastructure and authentication infrastructure, which also can be, but not necessarily, linked back to the root maintained at the Bundesnetzagentur, which is an official institution that does the oversight of the public key infrastructure in Germany. So people actually have those things, they just don't use them, right? This there is absolutely negligible uptake in the electronic identity and digital signature capacity of this or capability of this electronic identification card. Still, I think it's an important part that the rollout takes place and that the government still maintains its stance that this is important. Also in 2003, 2 years after the Anti-Terror-Gesetz, another piece of legislation of the Red-Green coalition of Schröder passed, and that was the Gesetz zur Modernisierung der gesetzlichen Krankenversicherung. So this is the law for the modernization of the what is it, health insurance, right? This was part of the infamous Agenda 2010 efforts of reforms of the welfare state. And in a way, it's an even more ambitious project than the just shown elektronische Personalausweis, because this law basically, so you see it's, what is it, article, is it actually on there? Oh no, it's not listed. I think it's in Article 5, Änderung des vierten Buches Sozialgesetzbuch, because this law mandated that every German would get such a card, the elektronische Gesundheitskarte, electronic healthcare card, since Germany has universal healthcare since actually 1892, welcome America in modernity, this means that every German will get such a card. Without going into too much detail, this card is basically the front end of an ambitious e-health infrastructure, including electronic health records for every individual. And if actually coming to fruition, would probably be the biggest electronic identity system worldwide. The card is being rolled out since 2011. By now there is 25 million of those out there, and they expect a total rollout within the next 2 years. So the important part here is that the digital signature on this card is compatible to the digital signature on the neue Personalausweis, on the electronic ID card. It's basically the same system, and you can use them vice versa, at least in certain parts of the system. Give me a second. Again, here is the issue that even though this system was mandated by law to be in place and up and running by 2006, the actual rollout only started 2 years ago, and the e-health infrastructure envisioned in this program is actually not implemented yet. Partly because there was fierce opposition by the medical community, by doctors, which feared the gläserne Patient, the transparent patient, which I think is actually not true, because the privacy infrastructure that is part of the elektronische Gesundheitskarte is a fairly sophisticated and interesting approach of dealing with the privacy issues in the medical context. But what it would definitely enable is to make the medical system much more transparent than it's today, and that was one of the reasons why it was implemented, because the government basically drops 250 billions each year into the healthcare system and has no good ways of tracing where that money goes. And basically medical community in Germany has managed to slow down at least the implementation of this project and is actively trying to prevent, well, I'd be cautious here, is actively trying to prevent to becoming more transparent than it is today. Okay, 10 more minutes, we need to rush. The third part of those aforementioned three policy projects by the Schröder administration was the so-called job card. And let me go back. This is interesting for the German listeners because the Agenda 2010, the social welfare reforms enacted by Schröder have been much disputed. And they go back to the, parts of them go back to this report by the Commission for Modern Services in the Labor Market, the so-called Hartz-Kommission, which basically led to the Hartz IV framework and so forth. And if you look at this long list of things that are mentioned there, you will see, I actually can't really see it here, you probably can't either, oops, that it says Signaturkarte on here. Right? So you have all kinds of things, Förderung älterer, Personal Service Agentur, Weiterbildung, Jugendliche Job Center, whatever, the usual welfare state, uninsurance employment issues, right? And among this, in 2002, they have Signaturkarte, right? So again, in Germany you see that basically the welfare state is being used as a medium, as a vehicle to implement digital identity, right? And next to universal healthcare, we have universal unemployment insurance also since 1892. And as part of this unemployment insurance, employers have to report the working hours and the income of the employees to the insurance entities. And this is done on paper to this day. And the vision of the Schröder administration was to do this digitally, and the system to do this had the name ELENA, Elektronischer Entgeltnachweis. Actually, this would have not included a card, because the Gesundheitskarte and the Elektronische Personalausweis would have had the signature necessary to use the system. So, there are some pictures of job cards. If you start to look around, it was called job card before it was called ELENA, but basically this was a cardless systems which would use the existing public key infrastructure provided by the two other cards to function. ELENA actually didn't come to bear because of the privacy issues. In this case, there would have been a central repository for all the data that was to be collected for the unemployment insurance, and the privacy risks were deemed as too high, and there was considerable political opposition to the system, and eventually it was scrapped in 2011. There are now new ideas how to do this, so expect in the next 2 or 3 years some new proposals how to reform the unemployment insurance and how to give it a digital infrastructure. So, oh, wait a minute. Okay, so basically my point here is that between 2001 and 2010, roughly, we have a second wave of attempts to create digital identities, at least in Europe and especially in Germany. That is to use the welfare state as a vehicle to implement a public key infrastructure and have a situation where you actually have use cases where the populations, where the citizens need to use that system, because people deal with welfare, with the welfare state and its provisions quite frequently in their life, right? Again, at the same time in the US, there is nothing really publicly visible. The private sector does interesting things, though. There is a, as some people will know, there's a lively debate going on in the US between 2000 and 2010. Competing systems for online identity federation, a lively debate about cryptographic protocols, and some companies, for in this case actually Microsoft, at least for some time, taking a very progressive stance with Kim Cameron publishing the 7 laws of identity and so forth. But on the government side, not much is happening in this time frame. Also, at the same time, what happens in the US, of course, is, and not only in the US, basically worldwide, is the rise of social media, Facebook, Twitter, Google Plus, and so forth, and of smartphones. So the IT landscape changes tremendously, and especially with what Bruce Sterling called the stacks, so Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, Apple, and Google, you have a massive concentration of online activity with very, very few actors which are based out of the US, which basically are in the position to identify people or to provide identity services. And this will come to bear in the third wave, which I will now talk about. And I believe we are now entering the third wave in the last 2 years, basically, since 2011. So it's almost 2014 now, which is actually 20 years after the Clipper Chip initiative. And as I said, we are looking back at almost 20 years of basically failed attempts by nation state to provide digital identities. Clipper Chip failed, the Signaturgesetz and all those lofty visions of Gesundheitskarte, elektronische Personalausweis and so forth, I just mentioned, also failed so far. There is no real uptake there because there's too little use cases, systems are complicated and so forth. But still, I would assert that the nation states have not given up pursuing their vision of creating basically public key cryptography based digital identities for their citizens. So let me skip a little bit of stuff here. So I spare you the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, which you probably all know. There is an interesting little note in there on identities, which I think have completely been invalidated by the current developments. In 2011, the Obama administration published the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, Enhancing Online Choice, Efficiency, Security, and Privacy. What is the acronym is NSTIC. So if you look for this, you will see NSTIC quite often. Basically, NSTIC is an invitation to civil society, to businesses, and also to government entities to engage in debate on the necessities and formats of implementations of digital identity protocols and formats. In a way, I think it's a regime of the responsibilization of the society for the problem of digital identity and delegates the thorny issue away from the states into the society. At the same time, the US government, of course, takes part in these debates and is an important stakeholder. Give me a second. So, oops, this is actually not readable. Sorry about that. So you see Barack Obama's signature down there. And the first paragraph here reads, as a nation, we are addressing many of the technical and policy shortcomings that have led to insecurity in cyberspace. Among these shortcomings is the online authentication of people and devices. The President's Cyberspace Policy Review established trusted identities as a cornerstone of improved cyber security. So the NSTIC process is supposed to solve this problem, right? Furthermore, the NSTIC, this is still quotes from the same document, states that central to the strategy's approach is the conviction that the role of the government in achieving the identity ecosystem is critical and must be carefully calibrated. On the one hand, the government should never overdefine or overregulate the existing and growing market for identity and authentication. If government were to choose a single approach to develop the identity ecosystem, it could inhibit innovation and limit private sector opportunities. So it is. I read those quotes to you because this is. This contains important policy directives which differ from what the European Union attempts to do, as you will see in a second. So it says the role of government is critical, and at the same time, the government should keep some sort of hands-off approach. Furthermore, on the other hand, the current market for interoperable and privacy-enhancing solution remains fragmented and incomplete, and its pace of evolution does not match the nation's need. So far, the problem statement. So how should, in the US context, an identity ecosystem come to bear? As I showed, the European approach, the German approach, is basically to create a system where the state issues you some sort of cryptographic credential, which enables you to authenticate yourself online. The US, at least when one would believe this paper, will take a different approach. Ultimately, the identity ecosystem can only be designed and built by the private sector. So think about this for a minute. What does this mean, right? This means, and I understand, I read the NSTIC basically as an invitation in this context, that the US government encourages the private sector, for example, the aforementioned stacks, Amazon, Apple, Google, and so forth, to actively engage in developing and building an identity ecosystem. The government pledges that it will support it and ensure that the identity system respects privacy and supports civil liberties of the individuals. And it also asserts that they will implement this identity ecosystem within their own institutions, right? Within their own services. Currently, the debate on how this ecosystem is supposed to be built is mostly taking place in the Identity Ecosystem Steering Group, which is a public-private partnership. And if you look at the membership list, it's really impressive. Yes, it's a very, very long list. And basically everybody you would expect is on there. And also everybody you wouldn't expect, like the American Civil Liberties Union and the Electronic Frontier Foundation and so forth. So I'm running out of time. I have to quicken up. Let's just skip through this. So another important point I want to raise your awareness to in context of the NSTIC is there is something interesting going on in this document when it comes to the question of where is the identity actually generated and who controls that. Remember what I said in the first part, that nation state basically monopolized the registers historically, and the European and the German example shows that this monopolization is also taking place in the context of digital identity provisioning. In the NSTIC, it's very hard to find out what the actual role of government-issued identity credentials like birth certificates, social security numbers, and all those things would be. And they talk about identity media is available in many formats and so forth. And then there is this little footnote on page 5, which basically says, for high assurance transactions, you may want to know their true identity. Now, what is the true identity? If you look into this document, you won't find any definition of true identity. You will find all kinds of crypto lingo, which is really interesting, and it's worthwhile reading because you get a very, you know, plain explanation of, you know, what credentials are and non-personal entities and so forth. But here there is true identity. So what might that be? On page 8 it says, the strategy, and this is the important part I believe, does not explicitly address identity and trust issues in the offline world. However, offline online identity solutions can and should complement each other. Identity proofing, verifying the identity of an individual, and the quality of identity source documents have a profound impact on establishing trusted identities. What are identity, identity source documents? Again, just like true identities, this is not defined within the NSTIC documents. I haven't found any definition. There is some online debates about this, which is interesting. But I believe what this actually means is that the government says, and it's totally logical to say that, I don't want to really scandalize it. What I want to scandalize is that this is not debated in the open as it should be, that the government basically remains the entity which will issue the source documents for true identities, right? Which will keep the registers. And those source documents might be birth certificates or something similar, right? All the ANSTIC in a way does is to invite the interested public in a debate how to render digital credentials on the base of the source documents and how to generate an identity ecosystem that makes both authentication and privacy possible. So in a way, if you think about it in the context of crypto lingo, the state remains the root entity that provides the initial authentication on which basis all other follow-ups of digital authentication should take place. Okay, we're almost out of time. Just let me jump to Europe. European Union, third wave, the indicator that the third wave is happening in the European Union is the proposal for a regulation of the European Parliament, of electronic identification and trust services for electronic transactions in the internal market. So the European Commission basically in 2012 floated this document and started to engage in a discussion of how to unify the existing many electronic identification systems of the member states. As I showed you, Germany has a really ambitious and fairly sophisticated ID card system, electronic healthcare card, and so forth. Other European member states have similar systems like France, Austria, and most of the Scandinavian countries. The current situation is that this that these systems are completely mostly incompatible, and especially not are not facilitating inter-European digital transaction based on the identity provisions these systems give. So what COMP 238 tries to achieve is a harmonization of the existing identity systems of the applicable laws and to force member states to make the systems compatible. It does not mandate that member states actually implement a digital identity system. So the European Commission does not say to some country that doesn't have a system like that, you need this. Right? It just says, if you have a system or if you start to build up an electronic identity system, it needs to be compatible with the other European systems. And of course, there is an important industry policy aspect to this because this is a market of 400 million people and there's quite some businesses in the European Union which compete to provide the services and the necessary hardware. Okay, I have to stop here, I guess, and I will take questions now. I can talk a little bit more about COMP 238 if you like. But so far, there is not much really interesting in there except that the security level that, for example, the German system would provide would not be maintained if this commission would not be maintainable if this commission proposal would come to bear. They would actually lower the security level there. Thank you.
So, thank you, Christoph Engemann. Okay, we have now, I guess, about 5 minutes for Q&A. So there are some people already standing on the microphones. And are there some questions from the internet? There are no questions from the internet, so stream, what are you doing? Okay, I think we will start with microphone two, because you stand there the most time.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the interesting talk. I just had a comment about NSTIC. So to understand the reason why they created it that way, it was when the person was appointed to work on this NSTIC, he had no experience in this identity management space. And the whole work was delegated to NIST.
Yes.
And the NIST guys, however, at that time, they had a project ongoing on smart grid. And that was supposed to be, or considered to be, a very successful effort. And so they had this notion of private public partnership, which was then later copied into the European Commission in various other efforts. Mm-hmm. And they looked at, talked to those guys, and then found out that they actually, in NIST, they had guys who worked on, developed, wrote the specification for the public key infrastructure, Tim Bolk in particular. And he, to understand some of the terms that you highlighted, this true identity, levels of assurances, identity proving, there's actually a document that Tim Bolk had written in the NIST special publication 800-63. And that explains what some of those terms mean. And it also explains what the role of the government is in that space. And what it's supposed to be doing is to create policy documents that explain what you have to do at the specific levels of assurance, different security levels, to fulfill the needs of the government for specific applications.
Yes.
And so while that's all great, it's a great idea and also sounds possible given that you have the identity providers already in the US established, which doesn't exist in Europe to the same extent. So far it had failed to, even for the US government as a consumer, to actually make use of their own technology they had been coming up, because there are already policies available for themselves as customers. And to my knowledge, none of those had been are so far in use.
In what was the last part?
So none of those sort of these trust frameworks are, and the technologies they had come up with for themselves, not talking about for the citizens, like for themselves as US government within their own infrastructure, within their own procurement processes. Even the deployment prior to that, the public key infrastructure they had created, which was one of the largest in the world, it took a very long time and had been very complicated.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'd like to talk to you after the Q&A. Thanks.
So, okay, thank you. It would be great if you have some shorter questions, please. So, because we have not that much time, so I guess 3 minutes left. So, but if you can't ask your questions here, I guess you will have a discussion later over there, I guess. So, microphone one, please.
Thank you. I think one thing that is very important to see the difference is that when someone makes activity in the web, it's not the identity that makes this, it's the person who holds this identity.
Yes.
So it's not a direct link to a person which cannot be changed. And I think we should keep in mind that it's not okay, that it's not a good idea to chip an individual from birth to death with a number. I think that there was activities in the past in our history from a very bad regime that we saw that it is a bad results of doing this. So perhaps how do you think about making this kind of identity more a temporary thing? So like when I need a taxi, I call a taxi and I get a taxi for a temporary time and I give it back them. So when I need an identity ID for internet transaction, I can go and get some for a temporary time and then it expires. So what do you think about such ideas, that such a ID does not last for the whole life, it's just for a temporary time?
Yes, well, in no way I wanted to sound affirmative of everything that is happening there. It was rather meant as a description. On the other hand, governments have this idea of life courses and of the necessity of a lifelong availability of an address of an individual, which is even more important if you have a welfare state which actually supports the life, biological well-being and so forth of an individual. So creating temporary identities is, in a government context, not feasible. And how to solve this problem of, on the one hand, the desire to have temporary identities and not have a fixed identity, and governments needing that, that's difficult.
Okay, so I guess one last very short question, and then please have a discussion later, so we're out of time.
Okay, yeah, you'll want to hear this one. So first, I'm aesthetics. Can somebody verify me?
Yes.
Okay, good, thank you. I say this because I believe I am the first pseudonymous member of the NSTIC/IDESG group, which mm-hmm. has created a number of interesting discussions within that group. Mm-hmm. By the way, regarding the first part of the talk, with regards to the American perspective, one of the key differences between Europe and America is that the United States does not have a national ID, and this has led to some of the confusion within that.
True.
And it's also worth noting that the whole true ID or true name thing has been a major topic of discussion, yes. which leads to the question I want to ask. Right now, we're within IDESG and NSTIC, we're doing a lot of discussion on terminology and mm-hmm. taxonomy, and I was wondering if you had any pointers or if there was a list of things that we could possibly learn from to collaborate with. So thank you very much for the talk.
Thank you. Not from the top of my head, but maybe we talk later and I think about it. Yeah?
Well, just a short question.
Okay, come on, well, very fast.
Too much identity could be a threat for privacy, but you're creating, I think, a class of Untermenschen who don't have an identity and don't get an identity card. There are rumors now that some cities in the Netherlands will not give social security numbers to Bulgarians and Romanians who don't have decent housing, so they won't be allowed to pay taxes, strangely. Have you a comment on that?
Well, of course, every identity infrastructure, if it's paper-based or digitally, is a system that differentiates between people who are part of the system and people who are outside. And in the context of paper-based identities, there is this notion of sans papier, of people without paper identities, like Flüchtlinge, damn it. Refugees, thank you. Who have a hard time living their lives and managing because they are without papers. And what sans papier or sans signature, or whatever you want to call it, would mean in the digital context, it's an interesting and also very scary question we need to think about.
Okay, thank you. So give him a last warm applause.